We are reconnecting with the traditions of Kreft. Not craft, it's Kreft on this hour of the morning show. We're exploring the mental dexterity and ingenuity that's born out of this old English word. The fencing, the haymaking, the knitting, the thatching and tanning, all evolving before massive factory production and certainly before our current embracing of all things do-it-yourself, where picking up a power tool is considered authentic. Alexander Langlands is a British archaeologist and medieval historian. He teaches medieval history at Swansea University in Wales. His new book is Kreft, an inquiry into the origins and true meaning of traditional crafts. Alex, welcome to the program.
Thank you ever so much for having me.
Well, before we get started, let's clear the air here about why you used the word Kreft as the title of your book and what, as you dug into it, what Kreft means. Can you help us out?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I studied as an archaeologist and then went and worked as a professional archaeologist for about 7 years. I've been involved in historic crafts as well as running a sort of small holding. And in all of those spheres of my life, I started to think about the sort of knowledge of how to survive. I mean, it sounds a bit extreme, but, you know, living in the past, what did it really mean? What sort of expertise and what sort of skill did you have to have? And then quite independently, I came across the old English word Kreft, which kind of means sort of the same thing, but there are some substantial differences. It's a word that they used over 1,000 years ago to describe something more than just making, to describe a sort of knowledge, a power and a wisdom. So when I started to read up a little bit more about how this word was used over 1,000 years ago, I started to realize that actually this is the thing that I've been thinking about, the thing I've been searching for, this kind of knowledge, this wisdom and this lost way of doing things.
Well, in our era of Etsy and do-it-yourself home projects that we see on HGTV, how are we so far afield, so different from crafts and crafting of today than we were 1,000 years ago?
I think, you know, and I count myself amongst these types of crafts people. I think when I sort of sit in the sun and make a basket from willow I've cut myself, there's an element of me that is connecting to the past practice and past ways of doing things. But also I don't have to worry whether that basket works or not. You know, my life isn't dependent on it. So I think we're always, when we're doing crafts today, a little bit detached from understanding craft in the past. At the same time, I think what we're also doing in this, what I think is a revival in hand making, is I think we're accessing a part of our brain and our bodies, which in the course of the last sort of 20, 30 years, we've been denied those opportunities. And I think that's kind of what we're doing. We enjoy making, we love making, we love giving objects that we make. And we do so because it's entirely natural to us. We have evolved to make things. We haven't evolved to sit in front of screens and press buttons all day.
Well, I was laughing at your chapter about how you learned to thatch a roof because you said it was completely revolutionary for you. It was the new Alex. This was 15 years ago when you learned how to thatch. What was so revolutionary about it to you? What was your aha moment?
I think with the thatching of the building, I absolutely love thatching and the methods and the techniques, and we were exploring a very traditional type of thatching, one that isn't done these days. We were doing what was called a stubble thatch, which is there's a way in which you used to harvest crops back in the 15th and 16th century that left you with a very long stubble in the field. And when I say stubble, I mean, you know, you're looking at a cereal straw here that's about 4 foot tall. And there's a way of fixing that. It's shorter than regular thatching straw, slightly shorter, but you would use it on agricultural buildings. So naturally, it's a style that's kind of gone out of fashion simply because we put sheet tin on buildings now. So I loved all those elements of it, but I guess the real breakthrough moment for me was in the thatching of this building, was in the resourcing of the materials. We must have spent the best part of maybe 2 weeks, getting on for 3 weeks, sourcing the bracken, which is a type of plant here which grows wild on the mountain, sourcing that, enough of that, to make the base coat. So whereas today we tend to think about doing a job, we're going to put a roof on a building, I'm going to call up a man, he's going to come around in a truck and dump a load of stuff off with us, I'm going to pay for that stuff, and then we're going to start doing the actual roofing, the making of the roof. Whereas in the processes that we undertook to build that roof, I was actually physically responsible for resourcing the materials. So all of the rafters I had to cut myself, all of the batten wood, which we used effectively, we wove hazel through the rafters, hazel wood, to make the kind of superstructure, if you like. We then had to go and source all this bracken, which I've mentioned, which took an enormous amount of time, to put the base coat on. And this is before we'd actually got around to putting the stubble thatch on. So that was a real kind of window into historic crafts, is that you couldn't just phone someone up and get them to deliver the raw materials. You are responsible for those. When you're responsible for those raw materials, you think about them in a much more critical way. How you use them, you think in a much more resourceful way. And that, particularly with the thatching, that came across.
The book is Kreft, an inquiry into the origins and true meaning of traditional crafts. Author Alex Langlands is with us. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you do crafts, whether they're medieval style or not? Do you think we've lost something by not making things ourselves? Do you know an ancient or medieval craft that you are trying to pass along or understand its origins? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Alex, you spent several seasons on the BBC series Historic Farms, and you were living and working on these period farms. How was that experience? How did that inform you for this book, Kreft?
There's a lot of those experiences bound up in the stories in the book. I mean, I started actually with the thatched building we've just talked about was one of the first things I did on a series called Tales from the Green Valley, which was produced all the way back in 2003. And I went on to do Victorian Farm and Edwardian Farm and Wartime Farm, amongst other bits and pieces on British television. But it was in the making of those farm programmes that, you know, we were charged with running farms as they'd been run back in the day, and I often get asked by people, you know, come on, how much time did you spend on the farm? You know, were you in the local hotel, you know, and then you get a hire
in
car
the
down
pub,
there.
Right? Yeah,
exactly. You know, and I was often asked about that, and one of the reasons I think the programs were so successful over here in the UK, and that they have a really good fan base over there in the States, is that in actual fact you can see that we were there. You can see that we were running those farms. And it is, you know, reality TV has become a cliche in so many ways, that there was an element of reality to it. You know, Tales from the Green Valley, myself and particularly Peter, we lived on site 24 hours for a whole year. Ditto with Victorian Farm, Edwardian Farm. We took on the livestock. We took on the arable parts of the project, and we lived it, you know, and also made a television program at the same time. So, you know, it was exhausting and incredibly busy. But it's only through that immersion, really, that you start to think critically about some of these processes. And, you know, you're spending a lot of time with craftspeople, learning all the while. I mean, I think that year I spent on Victorian Farm was the equivalent to studying for a 3-year doctorate. You know, the level of learning that happens when you're in that completely immersive experience. And, you know, actually, for legal reasons, we had to live in accommodation that had running water and heating and, you know, all for insurance purposes. But somewhere like Edwardian Farm, for example, you know, my Sunday genuinely was taken up with getting up first thing in the morning, going up to the farm, getting the horses out, getting them tacked up, getting them prepared for work, going out and, you know, giving them a really good working for two or three hours out in the winter on the hard ground. And then, you know, bringing them back in, soaping them down, giving them their oats, letting them off, and then going back to my cottage.
Long day. Working hard, working with your hands, we're exploring how traditional crafts are so much more than just making something. There's resourcefulness and ingenuity thread into what Kreft has taught us over a millennium. Alex Langland stays with us. His new book is Kreft, an inquiry into the origins and true meaning of traditional crafts. You can join in and ask your question. Do you know a knowledge of the real crafts of an old age? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back after the news. We're exploring the origins of Kreft on this hour of the morning show. I'm Kedar Chir-Kent. Medieval historian and archaeologist Alex Langland stays with us. He has us call to mind a fruit picker's basket, a blacksmith's plowshare, a shepherd's crook, or a scythe for cutting tall grass, ways of tradition on the farm that tell us really how so much has changed. It's all in the new book, Kreft, an inquiry into the origins and true meaning of traditional crafts. Your exploration of craft and what it means to you, your story is welcome at 800-642-1234. Where do you see artisanship today? Can you trace it to a medieval time? How are you attempting to keep a certain craftsmanship alive? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Alex, where have you seen the decline of Kreft, the evolution to where we are with craft? Where have you seen Kreft dropping off?
I think one of the key areas, I think, is in power and our access to power. We are now in a generation where we actually think nothing of, or for the most part, we think nothing of just pressing a button and having as much power as we require to do whatever job we want to do. And we use power tools. And, you know, in the book, I poke fun at leaf blowers, for example. I'm sure you have them in your part of the world. Mm-hmm. And the battery-powered pepper grinder is another implement that comes in for some stick in the book. And I think, you know, there's a sort of illiteracy of power in today's world where we just don't understand the significance. You know, when you have to do a job by hand and use your own power to do it, you think very differently about how you're going to do that job.
What about the factors that led to the Industrial Revolution and after the Industrial Revolution? Where was Kreft before and after?
Well, I think it's wrong of us to think that, you know, there was sort of craftsmanship before the Industrial Revolution, and then machines came in and took over the making of everything. And then we have an arts and crafts movement, which kind of takes us back. I think, you know, that's a simple narrative, and it's a dangerous one. And it's one I try and avoid that within the book by saying that, you know, craft becomes sort of self-defined when machines are being used to make things. All of a sudden, something that is crafted becomes a definition in opposition to something made by machines. But at the same time, the Industrial Revolution brought about arenas within which many, many more crafts were being practiced. There's almost an explosion of crafts as well. So it's wrong to make that simple difference between sort of machine making and hand making. I think the arts and crafts came along, and I think in this country, in Britain, we're still sort of living with that kind of idea of where craft sits. Craft is sort of part of art and almost sort of subservient to art. Whereas I have to say, in the United States, I think craft sits kind of outside of art in its own world and is practiced in quite a different way.
In what way is it practiced?
Well, I think there's more of an understanding of how important craft is to manufacture, to making. an understanding of how important it is to the individual and to quality, all those kind of ideas. You know, there's a raft of publications that have come out of the United States, which we've yet to kind of see in the United Kingdom. Richard Sennett's The Craftsman, for example, you know, Matthew Crawford's book on, you know, why office work is bad for us, and even Peter Korn's most recent book, Why Making Matters. You know, there's an awareness there that actually craft is not just about making something beautiful. It's about making something that works, and B, it's about making as something that we enjoy doing and defines us.
Going back to the book, there's a chapter on tanning, and as I was looking at this chapter and realizing I know so little about how a hide is tanned, what did you learn about tanning?
I just really liked the idea. There's a line in there about how when you first introduced the hides to a pretty noxious solution, basically with quicklime in it, so a very aggressive caustic solution.
And mind you, you've made quicklime in your life.
Yes, I have. Yeah, I have the scars to prove it. but I like the idea that the solutions, you would keep using them. So you got urine in there as well. So it's a really, I mean, tanning must have been the foulest of industries. And we understand, we don't find a lot of evidence, archaeological evidence, for tanning in medieval cities and towns, for the simple reason, I think, that they were probably kind of outside of the towns, downwind, so that you couldn't smell these things. It was this idea that you introduced the hides to, like, really kind of, the mellower the solution, and the aggressive solutions were on the other end of the spectrum, and the solutions went in one direction and the hides went in the other direction through a series of pits on site. And the fact that this is something that took 18 months to accomplish, it wasn't something you could do over a weekend. So if you've got any budding crafties out there that want to take up tanning, you know, need to be aware of the fact that it stinks, their family won't appreciate it, and actually just to get one hide takes about 18 months.
But there's also some pretty sophisticated chemical reactions going on. There's chemistry involved in this old world practice.
Yeah, I think what's amazing is that, you know, if we look back at tanning in the medieval period, it was incredibly sophisticated as a craft. You know, and there isn't a single temperature gauge or ometer anywhere in the whole process. There's no way of checking other than by hand and by eye. And you know, I think that's something that does come across in some of those crafts, that as you said, very, very complex chemical reactions are taking place. And you just had to understand that using the senses you had. It's quite interesting, actually. This came up recently. We've been looking at the copper works in Swansea. And Swansea, at one point, produced 90% of the world's copper, the height of the Industrial Revolution. And the lower Swansea Valley was just awash with copper works. And the process of smelting copper out of copper ore was very, very complex, because you needed to get out the iron content, you needed to get out the sulfur, the zinc, and all the other metals that you didn't quite want. And what's really amazing about these early furnaces is that actually they didn't have any dials on them. They didn't have any buttons. And the guys on the ground who were actually working these furnaces were really relying on their own instincts and their own skill to produce the world's finest copper. It's quite an amazing story there. And that's as late as the 19th century.
Well, when you were making quicklime, though, you were following a pretty specific recipe, if you will, that had been passed down. I mean, you had to do shovelful after shovelful in exactly specific number of shovels. How has Kreft brought us these quote-unquote recipes that are still in existence?
Well, I think this is part, you know, it's part of the knowledge, and it's strange because we've entered, and I think it's a good thing, actually, the digital economy is quite good at this, is we've entered a world now where we can access the manual, so we can get a kind of manual and all there is to know about making something. The fact is, you can't really teach it using words. whether you're delivering them in a book or in a video, you have to see it done. You have to hold the tools and do them yourself. So there's a certain amount of knowledge that comes from watching and doing. But as I say, we are in a world now where mercifully you can look up videos on how to do something. So the idea of knowledge transmission has changed considerably. And when we look back into the 19th century and beyond, there is a reason why you get families staying within particular industries for centuries, you know, four or five generations. And as far back as records go, families would do a particular job. And that's because there's a knowledge that's being passed on, incredibly detailed knowledge, which is being passed on between mother and daughter and father and son.
The book is Cruft, an inquiry into the origins and true meaning of traditional crafts. Medieval historian Alex Langlands is the author. He stays with us. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What old world tradition do you wonder about? Do you consider your hobbies as having ancestral roots that can be traced to Cruft? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kenneth in Janesville called in to say that he points to the Amish communities in Wisconsin and across the United States. He says everything that they do has craft involved in it. Alex, what are your thoughts on that? As you mentioned, families coming together around Cruft.
I totally agree. And in fact, I actually mentioned the Amish people because, you know, I've always been really, really interested in working horses, not heavy horses, ponies, but seeing working horses. And actually, I try and make this the case for horsemanship and how the great thing about a horse is, unlike a tractor, is it can feed itself, it can fuel itself, it can grow its own fuel. It doesn't need huge, great, you know, metal mines, factory processes to do a job that a tractor can do. And I'm a big fan of that. And of course, you know, there'll be criticisms that I'm a bit sort of nostalgic, and I am a bit nostalgic. I don't mind. You know, I can admit that. But actually, when you look at what the Amish are doing, it's incredible because they're using this fantastic piece of technology in the horse to the best of its ability. And, you know, this is a community that isn't struggling to survive in a modern age. You know, it's blossoming and it's flourishing. And I know for a fact a lot of the heavy horse people that I've worked with in the south of England speak very highly of the Amish. They've been out there, they've looked at what they're doing, and, you know, there's a lot we can learn from them.
Let's go to Sandy now, who joins us from Mineral Point. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Hey.
Yeah, go ahead.
Your guest. The fiber arts are alive and well in Wisconsin and in the United States. I apologize for my voice. I'm losing my voice. Knitting, spinning, crocheting, weaving, bobbin art, bobbin lace, tatting, all of those are alive and well.
Sandy, do you do fiber arts?
Yes, ma'am. I'm a dyer, a knitter, a spinner, an occasional weaver.
How did you learn?
I found places that would give lessons, and that's why I say it's alive and well. There's a couple of shows coming up, Wisconsin Alpaca and Fiber Show in West Bend. That's coming up in April. And then there's the Wisconsin Sheep and Wool Festival in September. So anyone who wants to learn more about these arts are more than welcome to come to these shows and take a class and learn something.
Well, Sandy, thank you so much for calling in and setting us off on the direction of the fiber arts. Alex?
Yeah, well, that's great to hear. It really is great to hear that there's a resurgence. And in some ways, actually, I think over here in the UK, we're benefiting from that resurgence over there in the States. I know, you know, there was a time, well, there still is a time in the UK, which is a country that, you know, made its money from sheep. It made its money from wool, Britain. And it's tragic to think that now it costs more for farmers to shear the sheep than the price they get for the wool in many cases. It's scandalous that this fantastic material. But the good news story is that some specialist growers, and actually my brother amongst them, he's got a flock of what we call Cotswold lions, which aren't actually lions, they're sheep. But they produce a fantastic staple. And, you know, there are now markets out there, chiefly in the United States, for this traditional English wool. And they're getting a good price for it now. So, I mean, I think the future is very bright for wool. And it's great to hear from your listener there that you've got, it seems so vibrant, the kind of things that you've got going on there.
Do you see that we're passing traditions on from one generation to the next? Sandy mentioned that there are conferences, there are conventions, there are events surrounding these arts. Is that one way that we pass on the tradition?
Yeah, and I think we need to be inclusive, really. You know, I think there probably was a time back in the 1970s when we had, I think, the first craft revival. I think there was a time then when we recognised that the last of a generation were dying off and that we were going to lose those crafts. And I think, you know, that's past now. I think the narrative of today is about reinvention, is about disconnect, is also about the kind of sustainability issue as well. We're thinking more about our planet. We have to. And all of those ideas, I think, are feeding into a resurgence of hand making, which I think everyone is benefiting from. And, you know, I'm a patron of the Heritage Crafts Association over here in the United Kingdom. And, you know, we're very keen to support historic crafts, heritage crafts. But, you know, we want to be a broad body. We want anyone to come in, whether you're a craftsperson or you're not, whether you're just interested in it, whether you want to find out more. You know, anyone is accepted at our events. It's a broad church. We want as many people as possible to get involved in the discussion.
Alex, why are you so nostalgic for this time period? You know, this is 1,000 years ago. A lot has changed. We've improved in so many ways in our infrastructure and where technology is headed. Why do you yearn for yesteryear?
Well, I sort of do in a bit of a cliched way. I think we dismiss nostalgia at our peril. And I think in some ways what we can see happening in the United States and in the United Kingdom at the moment politically, I won't go into it, it's boring. But, you know, I think it's in part because sometimes we're a bit too quick to dismiss the nostalgic frame of mind. You know, people love their past. They love elements of their past. And there was a value in the things we did in the past. I don't want to take everyone back to a time when infant mortality rates were higher and you know, winters were colder and so on and so forth. And I don't think you have to take the rough with the smooth when you look to the past and think, you know, well, that was a good thing. Let's cherry pick that, you know, and leave that behind kind of thing.
We're talking with author Alex Langlands, who stays with us discussing his new book called Kreft. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What old world tradition do you wonder about? Perhaps some fiber arts or another practice that you do? Join in at 800-642-1234. Medieval historian Alex Langlands became really enamored with Kreft as a presenter on the popular BBC's Historic Farm series. Here he is on the we don't have a clip of the Edwardian farm walking the footsteps of people in the early 20th century. Episode, they were making 10 tons of quicklime from limestone and firing a kiln. We're talking with Alex Langlands, who found the inspiration for his new book, Kreft. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What age-old tradition have you tried to rekindle in your life? Does it involve a kiln? What have you learned? Join in or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's take a listen now to a clip from Edwardian Farm, walking in the footsteps of people in the early 20th century.
We apply heat to it, basically, and that involves, with this kiln, creating a fire at the bottom, which we start with wood, then we put a layer of coal, and then layers of limestone, layers of coal, right up to the top of the kiln.
Well, I suppose the fumes are toxic coming out the top.
That's right, yes. It's something which, you know, you have to respect. The whole process,
yeah,
you know, involves a lot of chemistry, but the reality is it's a very caustic material. It can burn your skin. So we've got to be very sensible about the way we go about this.
Alex, you're making quicklime there. What were you using that quicklime for on the Edwardian farm?
We used it for a whole range of jobs on the farm, but the principal use was for fertilizing the fields. And you know what it does, without going into the chemistry of it, it sort of invigorates the breakdown of organic matter to release nutrients into the soil. And that's one of the ways you could unlock fertility within the soil, was by spreading it with quicklime. And you know, it really takes off in the 19th century and into the early 20th century, that method of fertilizing fields.
Let's go to Francisco, who joins us from Bailey's Harbor. Hi, Francisco.
Hi, good morning to you.
Good morning, go ahead.
Yes, I'm a Mexican. I'm an authentic Mexican in the United States. And we used to do our cooking with couches. We don't, any 10-year-old can harness a mule and an oxen, and they don't have the rudimentary medieval tools that you have. They don't know how to can, they don't know how to preserve foods, they don't, but now they're using fertilizers because of the American influence, fertilizers and insecticides. And here in America, we have lost that craft. And that's killing us. You're dependent on the technology to give more and more and more agricultural products. You used to get 80 bushels per acre. Now you can get 200, they say.
Well, Francisco, thank you so much for those reflections. Let's bring in Alex on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think with one of the things I've been really interested in is in food production. And, you know, the skill set that you require to grow. We are living in a world where we're slightly enslaved at the moment to chemicals and diesel. I think we've got the balance wrong in terms of how much we eat and what we eat. And I think we need to address those, as well as issues of waste, and take a look as well at the methods we used in the past, because they were sustainable, they were fundamentally sustainable. And, you know, I think they can still be useful. I know in some places in the United Kingdom, for example, there's much more emphasis on bringing livestock back into arable and crop-growing systems. Because livestock are a key part of that process. Their dung, their manuring of the soil is a very healthy and sustainable way to bring fertility to the soil.
Let's bring in Ken now, who joins us from Mayville. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I have you're talking about keeping an old craft alive. Turkey, the country of Turkey, is actually world famous for towels throughout history. And my sister actually lives over there and found there's a lady, who an entrepreneur that had started many businesses and was looking for a new business to start, and realized that the craftsmen that have produced the towels for centuries were a dying art. There were only a handful of them left, and they were aging rapidly. So she started a business around these towels, hired the craftsmen in, and they are actually in the process of training new craftsmen now. These towels are like none you will have ever seen. They are absolutely amazing. If you want more information or ways of purchasing them, I don't have the website, but if you Google Jennifer Towels and Turkey, you will get all the information. She should pop up like.
So, Ken, she's hired these craftsmen who are probably pretty old now, who are able then to teach it to younger workers?
Yes, yeah. And they're producing towels. I mean, she produces towels for like some of the finest hotels and stuff. But yeah, they're extremely thick. It's really a fascinating process and everything. But if anybody's interested, to learn more about them, you look online. Like I said, just Google Turkey Towels and Jennifer.
Well, Ken, thank you so much. And let's get Alex in here. Alex, what about the dyeing process and in Turkey, these towels?
What's really interesting about that story there is that sometimes it takes an outsider to see the value of a material and a product and quality, and to recognize quality. I think there's a great model there for how we go forward. We're sometimes a little bit wary and skeptical about people coming in, bringing a whole load of capital in and using ancient craftspeople, ancient craft skills, for their own business. But I think what we're seeing there is the benefits is that this craft is kept alive, that they're clearly offering apprenticeships, and it keeps the craft in good health. And that's one of the things we're very keen to do at Heritage Craft Association, is to find financial solutions in order to pay for that craft to be maintained, to be passed on to another generation. So, I've made a note there of something to go and Google in my lunch break, and that's what I'll do.
So blending the old with the new is really one way to hold on to craft?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I'm sort of critical of digital technology just because I get so fed up with my students and my kids and everyone in the world spending most of their life staring at a screen. I don't think it's good for us. I think the sort of epidemic of problems in terms of mental health and well-being is largely as a consequence of this. But, the digital economy does hold it represents a fantastic opportunity for lots and lots of different craftspeoples, because you can develop the networks there, you can sell internationally. And at the end of the day, people with money to spend, they want quality, they want a story, they want authenticity, and they want something that's been made with love and care.
Maybe that's why people really gravitate to a site like Etsy. Where is Etsy in this place of crafting?
Well, it's massive. And, that's a classic example of the digital economy there. It enables people really quite remotely as well to engage in a craft, to get really good at a craft, and then to get financial reward from those crafts. So I think Etsy is a great good news story. I'm always wary about something I call craft washing, is the idea that, you can slap the word craft or artisan or handmade on pretty much any product, irrespective of how it's been produced. And we don't seem to interrogate it. But I think, as consumers, we're getting better at that. We're getting better at identifying when a craft ale is a craft ale and when it's not, it's just a regular mass manufactured ale. So, I think we are learning.
What does crafting tell us about being human?
Well, we have been makers. We have evolved to be makers. And I think, I wrote this book, and I sat back from it for a couple of months and I felt that I had to put in a postscript, and I wrote a very short chapter at the end on craft craft and contemplation. And I cite the example of a dry stone waller who has got a gap in the wall, picks up two near identical stones and spends a moment just considering and contemplating which of those stones to use. And I think that's what we're lacking in today's society, is those opportunities for contemplation, not of the big kind of questions in life, who am I, where am I going, what's it all about, but just those moments of solitude and contemplation. I think that's good for us. It's incredibly healthy, and we need to reconnect with ourselves as makers in order that we can be happier, more self-aware, and more content.
In our last minute we have with you, what does the future hold for craft, and will we hold tight to these ancient traditions?
I think, I'd like to think as a historian and archaeologist that we hold tight to the ancient traditions because we see the value in them as what we call intangible cultural heritage, that it's important to record the past. But I also think the future is bright, because we are starting to realize that a huge island of plastic floating around in the North Pacific is not healthy, and that we've got to find ways of making and consuming and using in a profoundly different way. And I think some of those ideas from the past will grow again to become key ways of making and doing in the future.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolute pleasure.
Alex Langlands is an archaeologist, historian, and he's author of the new book, Creft, An Inquiry into the Origins and True Meaning of Traditional Crafts. This hour of the morning show was produced by Colleen Leahy and Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is The Ideas Network. Coming up tomorrow at this time, Helix, 23andMe, and other DNA sequencing services promise to tell you what foods you should and shouldn't eat, how you should exercise, where your ancestors are from, and so much more. It's all based on an algorithmic analysis of your genes. We'll look at the increasingly popular direct-to-consumer genetic testing industry and what these tests can and can't tell us about your health. That's coming up tomorrow at this time. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.